So this also could be titled, subtitled, How Mike Rubinstein Ruined My Summer Holidays Last Year. Because there was Tanya and I and a few other people in Les Ouches, having a nice month exploring the statistical mechanics of biomolecules and cells. And then the thing happened to me that's happened, I know, to several of you. You probably know that Mike and Ralph are writing a book. And when they get to a bit in the book which concerns things you've done, they start emailing you over prefactors, and more than prefactors, and things they've read and not understood, and things they've read and disagree with, actually, what you've done. So I started, just when I was wanting to look to start to think about pretty things like proteins, I started getting these annoying emails from Mike last summer. But so Star Wars were declared again. An extraordinary coincidence of data and questions last summer have left me in a constructively confused state. Oh, and I do hope people enjoy being in constructively confused states. A few people expressed feelings of grey misery yesterday that we seem not to understand what we're doing. I think it's great fun not understanding things. And whenever you get new experimental data on good materials, of course, you always learn you don't understand things. And I think Hiroshi couldn't have summarized it better yesterday. In fact, in his recent paper on dielectric rheology on stars, there is, I think, one of the best pieces of science writing I've come across, actually, in the last couple of years. In a journal like Macromolecules, we wouldn't expect anything else. But there's a paragraph where they say, puts the point that however accurate we are at predicting rheology, and we may have nice molecular models, unless the molecules are actually doing to within some approximation what we imagine they are, we're talking moonshine, we're deceiving ourselves. So let's try and look at the molecules as well. So the first thing that happened, actually, was I was aware of, is Hiroshi turned the great dielectric tool on 1,4 type A dipole polyisoprene chains. We all heard all about this yesterday, so we all understand it, onto star polymers. Now, the reason this is such a good idea is A, because star polymers are such fantastic teachers of how entangled polymer dynamics works. B, because the combination of dielectric and rheology, as Hiroshi explained beautifully to us yesterday, is very sensitive to what the tube is doing, or to how fixed the tube is. So you can show very simply that if the tube is fixed, like in a network, then both the dielectric relaxation, which is the current correlation of the end-to-end vector, So a star arm is doing its retracting thing. It's just losing correlations from the end up to the point to which it has experienced its deepest retraction, and the tube hasn't moved. Then the dielectric spectroscopy will just pick up the surviving tube fraction, period, because that's the only piece correlated with the original correlation of the chain. Of course, the rheology will do precisely the same. So in a fixed tube scenario, but dielectric rheology should produce precisely the same result. They never do, and that the difference is a rather sensitive measure of what the tube is doing while the chain is doing whatever it's doing. Okay, so there is a model which people have chosen to use in forms with or without correct prefactors for star polymers, for which Scott and I shouldn't really be held responsible because we more or less just put things other people had said together. But anyway, the MM model, and so this is Hiroshi's data on polyisoprene stars with about 8 entanglements per arm, or possibly 8 × 4/5, I'm not sure. But when you get the prefactors right, here are the data for G primed, G double primed, and the current model. Fortuitously spears the data in this William Tell fashion. Then he calculated or measured the dielectric relaxation on the same sample. Now, actually, I'm showing this a slightly different way to the way he did. He did this clever thing of using the dielectric data to predict the rheology under the assumption of tube dilation and showed that in, if you do that, the rheology is due measure doesn't quite agree with this backwards prediction. What I've just done is to go forward. So I've just done to, I've used the tube model with star retraction, with all the modes we know about, and calculated what I think the dielectric relaxation epsilon double prime should be, and that's the green curve here. It's not quite as nice, but, you know, shouldn't worry too much about that. But other worries came last year as well. The other worry was that Scott and Amélie Fischnecht pulled together data, diffusion data from Spartels at Al, who also measured the viscosity on monodisperse, multi-arm stars, with the idea of checking aspects of the terminal behavior. Of course, both the viscosity and the diffusion constant are very sensitive to the very terminal behavior of stars and whether tubes are dilating or what they're doing. But it's hard to interpret either one of them because they're both dominated by this whacking big exponential, you know the term. The viscosity goes various prefactors, who cares about them, and e to the some number m arm over m e. Right. That's the dominant factor, and the diffusion, the self-diffusion constant, is some other prefactors, who cares about them, actually we do care about them very much, times e to the minus nu m arm over m e. It's the same exponential form, and it's utterly dominant. So the clever thing to do is to measure both, and then take the product, because if you take the product, the exponentials cancel, even I can see that, and you're left with the product of prefactors, which themselves are very sensitive to your assumptions, like, how does a star diffuse? Okay, well, it waits for its arm to retract up the tube somehow, and then it takes a hop. Well, how far does it hop? Does it hop in the bare tube diameter? Because the arm's not going to hang around there very long, and you might think that it's a rather short time interval in which you can hop, in which case you might think, erroneously, that it hops in a small tube. Of course it hops in a big tube, because during the retraction, the branch point has been able to dilate by constraint release over quite a large area, and it'll have moved somewhere else. By the time the arm comes in, it'll go out, pin it somewhere else, it'll hop a large tube. But how large? Because when all the arms are retracted to the star point, there is no entanglement network left at all. So the naive, diluted entanglement network weight is infinity. Does it hop an infinite distance? No. Perhaps it hops the size of the tube has got to at this disentanglement transition, when the Rouse-like internal motion of a star arm can just about keep up with the dilating tube. That's my favorite criterion for a down dilution. That might be called the fat tube theory, or dilated tube hopping. So anyway, so Amélie and Scott carefully calculated this prefactor under both assumptions. And they both scale with the arm and number of entanglements in different ways. If you assume that the hopping takes place in non-dilated tubes, then this is the power law, and it's about minus one-ish. Yes. If you assume they hop in dilated tubes, it's a much weaker power law. It's up here. But what's more, there are prefactors here as well. There's a firm prediction. When you look at the data, you find that neither is true. You find, in fact, weirdly, that the scaling is the same as the scaling for skinny tubes. In England, they would be thin tubes. But the prefactor is larger. So the prefactor says the tubes are bigger, but they aren't as dilated as you might have thought they were. In fact, they're... So what is going on? This really isn't right. Then Michael started getting me worried. Okay, so tube dilation. I think I'd better do some chalk at this point. There is this idea that Pino invented called tube dilation, which was supposed to be a way of thinking about constraint release. When applied to linear polymers, it doesn't seem to work very well. I think we understand that by now that the constraint release in linear polymers really has to resolve in the tube Rouse constraint release sense that both Mike and Alexei have told us about. But for star polymers, the situation is really, really quite different, because for two reasons. One is the dynamics of the star arm are not diffusive in a flat potential tube. They're activated. So they're exponentially slow and activated. So what this means is that the time for the end to retract to some distance x here is typically, for a long arm, exponentially shorter than the time it takes to get x plus a little bit further. These get exponentially longer and longer and longer times. In that interval, the constraints around this tube that arise from other star arms, there's a relaxing at time scales exponentially faster than this, pop in and out many, many, many times. So the bare tube, in which the bare chain finds itself at high frequencies, has the opportunity itself to retract, undergo Rouse-like motion. This one. You can discuss anything you like. Yes? Ask questions. Do as you have been doing.
Retraction waiting time is large.
Yes.
Retraction process is extremely fast.
I agree.
And so as our retract, it obviously is finished.
I disagree.
Retraction process, if you look at current experience, you don't spend much time.
No, you don't.
And so effectively, if the vessel is still there and doing nothing for a given year, but then it's...
That's right. That's absolutely right.
But when it does that, the topological environment around it is effectively fixed. It's different, but it's fixed.
Okay. Okay. Right. But nonetheless, constraint release events do occur. So this chain has a choice of how it might retract to here. It might retract in the skinny tube, herniating like so, right? Or the fatter tube might itself, via constraint release, do most of the work, herniate, so that the chain itself doesn't require to create as many unlikely unentangled loops at the level of the small entanglement spacing, or some mixture of the two. So this is really the cartoon for tube dilation. But what's not obvious is that the most likely way that the end of the chain gets here is to exploit the largest tube that it possibly could. And that was the assumption that Robin Ball and I made in 1989 when we implemented Pino's idea for stars. Now, the other issue which had been unclear until, well, at least unclear to me until last summer, is an accurate understanding of the payoff between these choices. You see, there actually is an advantage in staying in the thin tube. The advantage is that the only drag you have to suffer is the bare Rouse drag. The difficulty is that you have to do it in this nasty potential, which looks like U naught. Shall I put gamma over 2? Let's have z, the number of entanglements per chain. X squared, there it is, okay. It's a nasty big potential whose height, for complete retraction, scales us gamma primed. Well, okay, it's up there. I don't think I'll lower it down until we've finished, actually. You know, so well, but it's got the bare Rouse drag. Now this guy is in a fatter tube. It's a little tube which is doing the retraction. It's the polymer, so it has a smaller Z. In fact, it's looking at some Z tilde, which is Z multiplied by the entanglement fraction. So the effective fraction of polymer. And if all the chains more or less are on their way from retracting from 0 to 1, and if this is X, then the assumption of maximal dilution is that everything which has been dumped out of the oriented entanglement network so far acts as solvent for everybody else. So the fraction of effective network left is just 1 minus x. Okay. Now, this means that the effective tube potential that the fattest chain you can imagine feels at this point is a diluted, let's call it the diluted potential, which is the one we first thought of, gamma over 2, x squared, but just diluted by 1 minus x. Oh, yeah, it will be important. Yeah, it might be. Okay, yes, thank you. This might be 1, or it might be 4/3, or it might be all sorts of other things near 1. For the purposes of this morning's discussion, I'm going to take it as 1. But clearly, because all these things live in an exponent, they're all important, because they all end up here, being multiplied by a big number and having their exponential taken, which is a nasty thing. Now, this potential, you can see what it does. It finishes down there. That's the diluted potential. It looks awkward at first, and it was the awkwardness that I didn't like. It looks awkward, and it goes over a maximum, and you finish with nothing at all. So there's clearly something unphysical about this potential. So I thought, well, I now claim that there's nothing unphysical about this potential at all. This is precisely the appropriate potential at timescales corresponding to retractions to point X if you take a solvent, everything that's relaxed up to this point. In Cramer's theory, that turns out to assuming that the effective diffusion for your retraction motion is governed by the slowest things that can happen to you. Because that's the other payoff. You see, it's nice. This fat tube can retract in a pathologically, apparently, weaker potential, but it's got a much larger effective drag. Because it's not just free Rouse, it's got a drag which is controlled by other entanglements, which are other exponentially activated bits of other stars trying to get out of the way. So in actual fact, there's an exponentially larger drag going on in there. Now, how do we get around this? We wrote down an approximation which is appropriate to Cramer's theory in varying diffusion. So let's suppose that there is reaction coordinate x, there's a variable diffusion constant. And let's actually write down the Cramer's expression for this, which is, it's some effective length at the bottom. Right, okay. 2 pi over the second derivative of the potential at naught. That doesn't matter. There's an integral. This is the thing that matters. Up to x of 1 over dx primed e to the u of x primed dx primed. I mean, that's the Cramer's expression for the first passage problem for a particle in a well of ux with a x-dependent diffusion as well. Now, the crude differential equation that we wrote down those years ago, that if I want to know how long it takes me to get a little bit further in x, I have to wait the time that it takes to get to where I am now, and then slow myself down by a little Boltzmann factor. Well, let's put kt equals to 1 du by dx, right? That actually emerges out of this, where this U effective is. I can always within this Cramer's formula pop the diffusion up as a logarithm in this exponent and write this as U. That is U naught here. U naught minus log d. So what Robin and I wrote is actually right at the level of the exponent for Cramer's theory, providing we interpret the effective potential as combining a bare potential and a drag. So how does that work? When we solve this, this turns out to be just U naught diluted by the 1 minus x factor. We reintegrate that, and you know that the effective potential is now gamma of 2 z x squared over 2, which is the first term, multiplied by the integral of this, multiplied by the derivative of that, which is just then x, so I get minus x cubed over 3, x squared. That's what we got, and that's this effective potential, which comes up into a maximum. That's U effective. We now see what that effective potential does is to combine a diluted bare free energy, which is there. You know, I'm just at every time scale, I'm sitting here and I've diluted the tube and it's a big fat tube, plus a bit extra, and the bit extra is the drag, which is what ought to happen, because by the time I've relaxed the entire star arm, there's no potential there at all, but these are little stars moving around, diffusing with a huge amount of drag that comes from their arms. And that's this. Yes, indeed.
So can you speculate on the form of that drag?
Absolutely. I can do more than speculate it. We can calculate it. Okay? Because the drag, another result of Cramer's theory, at the level of the exponent, is that the actual time to get to x is just e to the blah, 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 bare potential divided by the effective drag at that point. That's true at the level of the exponent when you evaluate this integral asymptotically for large values of its argument. So because we've calculated the whole timescale spectrum by using the correct incremental differential equation, which we can deduce from this, and because we know that the difference between the times we've calculated and the bare potential has to be the drag, we can calculate the drag. And it's the difference between this function and the other one. Yes. 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 We're assuming that the whole retraction process of a star is a Cramer's problem, and we're also incidentally assuming, see later, there's only one dominant mode. That's going to be a problem because they're all the Rouse modes, but it's one particle, say the lowest Rouse mode in a potential, that the potential is effectively time dependent because it's an entanglement potential that's been diluted by everything else that's relaxed so far. I haven't made this self-consistent yet.
What assumption are you making about d?
Okay, the assumption that I'm making about d is that the assumption about d is a consequence of assuming that it's the problem is a Cramer's problem, that it's the time scale, the diffusion time for my current tube is dominated by the longest relaxing segments that just let me move my last piece.
But what is drag?
That is the assumption making about the drag. That the drag is dominated by those the entanglements which have just relaxed on me. I don't know it yet.
If you don't know it, how can you solve
it? Oh, well, I'm going to find out. The implications of my assumptions are that I know it. The reason I know it is because it comes out of this assumption.
But you're making everything, you're assuming whatever D is, you get its answer, which is not very correct.
To put it another way, delta B has an influence on the truth calculating now that, which is in the dynamic solution equation.
Yes. No, okay, yes, right. The answer is, of course, I am making a physical assumption about D of X. I am making a physical assumption about D of X. I must be, and it's in this statement here.
So you can take the gap, whatever it is, to give me an assumption. Whatever you need to give me an assumption, my favorite answer.
Well, It just simply amounts to saying where's this drag coming from? This drag is coming from the release of entanglements. Right. So which entanglements what average over releasing entanglements am I making to calculate D? I'm making some assumption over the ensemble of entanglements that have already relaxed up to my current time scale to calculate D. Okay. I think what I'm going to do now, and this is what I hoped would happen, right? There's going to be this. I would love to have a discussion following this. Okay. So I think now would not be the appropriate. Oh no, there's no time for it now. But okay, sure. This is one of the discussions we'll flag next week. Okay. What I claim is that this assumption is equivalent to the physical assumption of calculating a drag which is strongly weighted to the slowest constraint release events that I felt till now. We can discuss that, but that's my current claim. There is a claim in here because I can calculate what the diffusion is by that's the physics I claim, which is going into this assumption for the effective potential. It must be, because that is the way I calculate the drag. To answer Lindzen's question, let's just do this sum, and the answer is we get the exponent of that difference there. So the drag turns out to be at the level of the exponent gamma primed over 2 x cubed over 6. That's this difference function in there. Now, then you have to ask, look, this may not be the best choice for the chain to make. So there's an additional self-consistency requirement on this physics. Suppose that this is the correct expression for the drag. You can then ask the chain, well, is this the best thing to do? So at every time scale of retraction of this thing, you can give the chain a choice. You can say, you can make the next little movement either by relaxing very weakly but with huge amounts of drag in the biggest tube you've explored so far, or you could select among all the cascades of different tube sizes that you can exploit and move around at different rates, but with different penalties of potentials. And you can minimize the time it takes to make one more hop over that process. What that amounts to doing is writing for the effective potential, not z diluted by 1 minus x, but z diluted by 1 minus some other x tilde, say, which amounts to only moving so fast that you only allow other people's entanglements from 0 to x tilde to help you. You can calculate how long it would take to make this next retraction by minimizing over all that, and it's not a difficult sum, but there isn't time to do it now after all, but we'll try and do that in our discussion. And you find the following. You find that actually the best thing to do is to exploit the fattest tube you can access, okay, because that's the best payoff. It's a sharper function that reduces the tube potential down, then it gives you drag up just about all the way to here. So it seems self-consistently the right thing to do, but there's one problem, which is that the unphysical potential that we didn't like at first now turns out to be much more physical. And if maximum tube dilation is the choice, then for each retraction timescale, this is the correct potential, and the physics changes at this point. So what this tells you is, because after this, the fully diluted potential is downhill. In other words, a fully dilated problem would be a driven problem from this point, which is two-thirds up the length of the arm, by the way, for independent of molecular weight. And that's not self-consistent anymore. You could calculate how long it would take to fall down the hill, and it's very quickly, very quick. It's far quicker than the tube could exploit its new dilated tube. So something else, the physics changes here, and the tube may dilate, some other physics cuts in, constraint release, but it's no longer the correct picture at this point. And the time scale is going to grow at some self-consistent rate, which steers a course between the effective the exponent of this effective potential and the exponent of this one. Okay, so what's the results of all that? I thought I had to show this data. Hiroshi, I thought, was going to show this yesterday. Then, so having gone through all this and convinced myself that I was confused, Hiroshi then measured his 15 entanglement star. Is it 16? 13 entanglement star, yeah. This is the shock. Okay, so this is the same plot. This is the dielectric data, rheology, and dielectric in green data on the 13 entanglement star. This is what we thought. The rheology tells us that there's no special relaxation time. Everything is smooth, completely smooth distribution, just as we always said, Doi-Kazu, Pearson-Helfand, blah, 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 blah. The dielectric says, oh, lovely and smooth here, till about this relaxation time, that I'm going to save everything up for an almost Maxwell peak at the terminal time. Completely different picture. And I don't know any better illustration of Hiroshi's point that you better look at the molecules, or if you just have rheology, you're kidding yourself. So something is going wrong. But actually, the amplitude under this peak happens to be consistent with the dielectric amplitude from the final third of a star arm, relaxing at more or less the terminal time. But then, just to make things better or worse, Ron visited us in Leeds and told us about the lovely joint simulation, the slip link simulation between his group and Massa's group, which is an off-lattice, non-real space slip link simulation of retracting star arms, which we may hear a little bit about next week if we have a slip link morning. Perhaps we should. I hope we do. Which came to the independent conclusion that the terminal behavior of stars has special physics and is controlled by rather particular topological interactions from deep segments of two, or possibly more, but in their case two, because they're binary interactions, two stars that are relaxed by an entirely different way. But that is also consistent with the rheology not really noticing this very much. So the local orientation, this rheological function, seems to be able to enjoy a mild, gently expanding tube, while there are a very few rare entanglements pinning the remaining end-to-end correlation for the dielectrics. Now, that does seem to be consistent with this picture of tube dilation, but this really, I hope, raises far more, and it has raised far more questions than I've answered, so I haven't really broken my own rules. No, I'm not going to talk about that. Scott's going to talk about that. There's an even worse puzzle with stars that we don't understand that Scott's going to talk about in just a minute, among other things. So I hope I've confused you as much as I've confused me. I see we have. So thank you, Hiroshi and Mike, for and Masao for unleashing Star Wars again. I hope we learned something. Okay, I'm going to stop.